Welcome, listeners, again to Food Conversations Season 5. Again, before we move on with the show, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shikwemeq people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, today, we have the pleasure of welcoming into our studio a woman who has become a fixture at the teaching garden run by the Shuswap Food Action Society. Elmarie Roberts is a consummate and dedicated teacher who has taught for decades in a variety of settings and on two continents. For her, teaching is really a way of life and a way of giving back to the community. Welcome, Elmarie, to Food Conversations.
Thank you, Warren. Thanks so much for raising the profile of food and food security.
We're pretty focused on making sure that people become aware of food sovereignty, more than just food security, which is having enough food, but food sovereignty, that people can choose the foods they want and know it's available to them. Now, when we spoke before the show, I asked you a question about your name, because it's a name that's a little unusual in this part of the world. And I had scoured the internet for answers to that question, and no brilliant website about name etymology could tell me what it was all about. And you told me in a single phrase. Where does the name actually come from, this Elmarie name?
It's a combination of Elizabeth and Maria, essentially a family name, and very common in Southern Africa.
And it's there because of sort of the Elizabeth, the queen.
In the 50s especially, many moms named their girls after the queen, yes.
The queen, well, now they'll be calling their sons Charles, maybe. Who knows? Now, I also recall something that really struck me about the very beginning of your association with plants and qualities of plants, and that was that your father was a horticulturalist and a greenhouse, and in that greenhouse there were aromas and scents that you can still evoke in your mind. What kind of aromas and scents do you remember? What were you smelling?
Primarily orchids and flowers. My father loved growing flowers. And when I started off as a small-scale farmer, I made sure there were enough flowers.
So flowers are something that you really have a special appreciation for.
Yes.
Well, that's good, because they do smell nice. I just got some peonies from one of my staff, and the whole living room is smelling like peonies right now. Born and raised in South Africa, are there scents and aromas and odors from plants that are very characteristic of the country?
Frangipani?
Yes.
Are you familiar with frangipani?
I am very familiar with it, yes.
It's a reminder of summer. It smells like sunblock, like sunscreen. In fact, I think...
they probably stole it.
And bougainvillea?
Yes, bougainvillea, yes.
And the beautiful honeysuckle.
When you catch a whiff of any of those plants and the others that are familiar, how does it affect you? Do you feel homesick, nostalgic, or...
Absolutely, immediately, as you know.
Yeah.
A very powerful connection between scent and memory.
Yes. And emotion. It's interesting. People can feel emotions immediately, as you just described, when a certain scent comes along that they associate it with a particular experience in their lives, and especially a nice experience, a pleasant experience. Now, you, in your early years, were aware of a desire to become a teacher. Where do you think that came from, that very clear understanding in your own mind?
It came from a very good teacher herself. She was so good that I wanted to be like her.
So what was she like? Let's nail it right down.
She taught me so many aspects of life, not just the subject. And to me, that is the essence of a good teacher, as we are all connected, all life forms are connected. And We learn from each other by observing and teaching and education.
It's widely stated that if you're a salesperson, you're really selling yourself. And then the product sale comes right after that.
She wasn't the only one. I realized the value of education from a very young age. And that essence of wanting to share something good. I realized that this person was sharing something good.
And you were taking it in. And at which point did you decide to make it a formal venture in your life, to not just want to be a teacher, but to take steps to make that happen?
It was after school and deciding on what to do with my life,
and
my career.
The city of Bloemfontein came into your life.
That's
why don't you tell the listeners about that?
It's having been born in the apartheid years, was very much considered an Afrikaans pocket of society, but my experience was different. I was exposed to having breakfast and lunch and dinner with the businessman from Johannesburg's daughter or son, the local mayor from the South Sotho community. I didn't know always. To me, I didn't realize I was speaking English, Afrikaans, and two other ethnic languages intermittently.
Sesotho or something.
Intermittently.
Yeah. Because there was a sense that people were just people.
Exactly. It was only when I moved out of the town that I realized. There were things happening that I picked up on. For example,
right.
My own wonderful experience at a very good school, and realizing that other people not so far from me didn't have that experience. And also the buses were huge. They were not integrated, and I was looking through the window, looking at people walking to school, and I realized what's happening there from a very young age. And because everything was so heavily censored at the time, I of course didn't realize that, but afterwards there was a huge backlash from especially the students.
You know, that's the way it is all around the world. When somebody's doing something that's unfair,
Yes. They
don't advertise it. When somebody's doing something that they want people to see as fair, then they'll talk about it till the cows come home.
In fact, we were also concerned that nobody could share our churches. Sitting here in a church right now, I'm just reminded of that. And we started underground church services for everybody.
Really?
And the whole community came. And it was wonderful. In our basements.
You know, it's what somebody said once, that the biggest environmental organization in the world is the world's religions collectively, because all of them teach that nature is creation and it's divine and it's worthy of our respect and protection.
Yes.
So you were there. You were there at the beginning.
Yes.
So you went to school in Bloemfontein. You went to a college there, university college. That's where you saw this sort of universal approach to everybody being in the same boat. But you were studying specifically English and German, and you said it was German again because of a teacher.
Exactly. She taught the love of a language to me, and we all know how difficult that can be, learning another language and especially appreciation for that language. I went to the University of the Orange Free State, it was called at the time.
Right, indeed. And Bloemfontein, I believe, is the capital of the Orange Free State.
Yes.
The end of your program was to earn a teaching certificate.
Yes.
And that's how it's done in South Africa. You learn a subject, and then you get a teaching education on top of the subject that you've learned. Is that how it works?
That's right. It's can be compared to a master's in education, but not quite. It was more practical to open the doors to teach.
So you'd actually do practicums. You'd actually do some teaching activities.
All over the country,
yes. Now, Bloemfontein means fountain of flowers.
Yes.
So there must have been some flowers in Bloemfontein where you're growing up. Was that where the frangipani and bougainvillea were, on street corners and around and about?
Oh, yes, and the roses. The roses.
Okay.
Of course, the roses. In fact, it's known as the City of Roses.
Yes, I remember reading that. Yes, I did a little homework.
Yes.
Do you miss flowers being as abundant as they were when you were growing up and surrounded by them, especially the ones that have a scent that is captivating?
Absolutely, but I mean, it's an easy fix, isn't it?
You grow some flowers.
And I'm just so blown away by the local flowers here and the difference in the flowers, and especially the wildflowers and the indigenous flowers. So I'm really leaning towards all the flowers that have been growing here for thousands of years.
Do you have a few flowers in your garden?
I don't.
You don't? Well, that will get you up to the teaching garden.
I squeeze them in pots wherever I can.
Yes, indeed. Well, they do well if you give them the right circumstances, don't they? So you taught for a few years, about a dozen years in South Africa. What was that experience like in terms of how you got into the role of being a teacher and experiencing it in a practical sense?
I really enjoyed it. I found it very interesting and challenging because it was away from my home, and it was a different environment. In fact, it was a very conservative area that I found myself placed in, and I leaned towards changing the world. We all want to change the world. And we had this whole program at school. And the more we discovered about changing the world, we realized how important localization is.
Indeed, it really is. Just remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Elmarie Roberts, who is a consummate and dedicated teacher working with the teaching garden here in Salmon Arm. The essence of teachers is, again, to present yourself to your students as a person who cares about what you're teaching and about them, too.
Exactly. And most of all, to me, it's walking the talk. And you mentioned the local Food Action Society. Warren, when I arrived here, I observed a lot. And they stood out as walking the talk, not just during coldest night of the year and with supportive grants from the Shoe Swap Community Foundation, wonderful group who gave me a grant of $500 to start up this permaculture garden at the teaching garden.
Yes.
And that went a long way towards paying the very pricey water bill.
Indeed. I think this part of the world is understood to be a place where volunteers play a very important role. One of the heroes, or mentors, or whatever you want to call it, very important people, was Lawrence Anthony. You mentioned him when we were chatting before the show, and so needless to say, I had to look up Lawrence Anthony, and he was a very extraordinary human being. Bold and almost, some people called him foolhardy. But I was struck by some of the things he did. One was to go to Kuwait and reestablish the most famous zoo, if you like, outside, say, you know, wealthy countries like in Europe. He actually went there in the middle of the Iraq war and saved the small remnant of animals that had not already been killed or had not starved to death, and brought back the zoo. I'm sure you knew about all that. What did you think about that? How did that inspire you?
Once more, he's a person to me who walks the talk. He believes that all life forms are connected. It's not just about ourselves and our own families and our own kin, but all life forms are connected. In reading his works, you will notice just how close he came to elephants and communicated with them. There is this unspoken education and mentoring and communication in life forms.
There was a media report of a reporter going out with him to the reserve where the elephants were They were recalcitrant elephants who had been rescued from the local population where they were living initially because they were trampling fields and that kind of thing, and he brought them to this reserve he had established. But with the reporter, he just spoke out, said something, and said, "They'll be here." And within a couple of minutes, the vegetation parted, and one elephant came out. And before a minute or two had gone by, there was a whole herd of elephants that had come from quite a distance away in response to his call.
That's right. And when he died, Warren,
Elephants came.
They came to pay respects.
Astonishing. They came, and I think they stayed for several days outside his home, just honoring him.
That's right.
I think that, to me, that's such a touching story because it goes straight through all of the loose statements that are made about our relationship with the animal kingdom, and it points to an example of something that was really quite clear demonstration that there was a connection between these very large, very different animals and us as human beings, if there's a sort of a love connection, you might call it. He also went off to Africa, sort of more northern part of Africa, and intervened with a terrorist organization that was kidnapping girls and doing all sorts of things, but also unwittingly destroying animal life, rhinos, in their country, and spoke to their leaders, astonishing them with the news that they were doing such harm, and persuaded them to change course. That must have captured your attention as well when you heard about that.
I'm aware of his close connection with his local mentor and chief of the Zulu Nation, one of the descendants of Chaka.
Right.
And so he knew the importance of relationships, of social advocacy and wisdom and humor. When the poachers came onto Tula, the game reserve that still bears his name, and his wife is still active there, he dreamt up a wonderful way of approaching poaching. And in many ways, and a lot of it showed a clear understanding of the local people.
So he didn't just say stop poaching. He made it so that it was more valuable to stop poaching than it was to continue doing it.
Exactly, and that's where education comes in again.
And it's even more than education in a certain way, Elmarie, because he's reaching out into the world of the people that have been identified as a problem, saying, well, they're not really a problem. They're in a situation where they behave that way because of the situation. Change the situation and they will behave differently.
Exactly.
Well, at some point you decided, well, there were circumstances that arose in your life that said, let's cross the oceans to another part of the world. How did that happen?
Following family, following my husband's career, and
he's an engineer.
Yep, and we were delighted to discover this beautiful, peaceful country, and decided to make it our home. It was only going to be on contract, but after 4 years, we became proud Canadian citizens, and my heart is still, of course, in my land of birth, as
it always
is. It always is. Yeah. And this is my country now.
Yes, we moved here in 79, intending to stay for a couple of years.
Yes.
Sometimes the world unfolds in a different way. So you came to Canada, and you ended up on the island, Vancouver Island. Yeah. That was because, I presume, your husband had work there. But you moved on as well. You did some of your own things.
Yep.
You worked with autistic adults. You became a community worker. How did did that come about, and what was that experience like for you?
Well, just background again in teaching experience, working and alongside people who have autism in South Africa at designated schools there for people with autism, which was an incredibly valuable experience for me. I only taught there for a short while, but I had that inherent experience that I could use here. And
how did it affect you? What did it teach you that has stuck with you?
It taught me, it made me humble, first of all, very humble, and then observation once more, that first permaculture principle of observing, sitting back and observing, just observing very closely.
And when you observe, what did you see that has stayed with you and shaped your way of looking at teaching in general, for example?
The fact that we all learn differently. Mm. We all learn differently. And the most powerful one is doing it and seeing it. Learning by doing.
Walking the talk. That may be a motto over a door somewhere. You also became connected with the farming community. How did that come about? Because it's an extension of being a teacher, and it's moving into a sort of a different area. How did that come about?
I was volunteering at an incubator community farm near my home at the time.
And now, an incubator means a place where you develop farming practices and people who do them, that kind of thing?
That's right. An office space for farmers, if you like. And it's, the land belonged to the municipality. There was a wetland on it. And after fears of it being removed from the agricultural land reserve, the municipality, who showed incredible vision at the time.
With a little help from its friends?
Yes, the community, who strongly socially advocated for this wetland to be restored and preserved, and the adjoining agricultural land to be used to grow food for the community. This was in 2001. And long story short, today it is a thriving farm. It's seen...
Oh, tell us a little more of the story. It's a really... you laid it out for me, and it really is a pretty impressive story.
It is. It's, I wish there were more places like Halliburton Farm in Victoria, simply named after the road it's on, so people could find it. There have always been people trying to change that name, including myself, because it's the name of a gun factory in the United States. but it's named after the road. And it's a success story. It's a sustainable model. It has been duplicated, that model, in the seed incubator farm in Duncan, in Port Alberni, Intervale, in the east, many, if you just look at incubator farms. And so once more, it's because people saw something good, and because they saw something good that worked, they knew that without many problems to the municipality. Municipality did not want to administer it. They didn't want any trouble from the neighbors. They didn't have money to put towards it. And so a society was formed, and this is society named, they did it all. They made sure that it was run effectively, that the books were squeaky clean, the accounting was squeaky clean, that there were regular reports back to the municipality. And today, with its own climate action plan, it's fulfilling the municipality's own climate action plan. And I just saw the many collaborations, not just between the decision makers, but also, Warren, it addressed education, it addressed mental health, it addressed employment, and most of all, food security, because people were, they had to grow food there. And that was the one aspect that the municipality wanted in the first place and looked at very carefully.
The municipality was persuaded, if I understand correctly, to actually purchase the land on the condition that they didn't have to run it, right?
Yeah, and there was a structure on it.
Yes.
and they didn't. The structure could be used as an educational space and to prepare the produce.
Extraordinary. I just remind listeners that I'm speaking with Elmarie Roberts, who is a consummate teacher and a dedicated volunteer at the Shushop Food Action Society's Teaching Garden. So you used a phrase that when we were talking about it, you said, I was smitten, working with farmers, and somewhere in this mix, you went to Camosun College, and you deepened your knowledge of farming, but in a particular way. Why don't you describe the degree or the certificate, the diploma you got from Camosun College, and the fact that it was not just about farming, but about the business of farming.
Exactly, because we didn't want people to embark on something that wouldn't be profitable to them financially. So that's where a good business model came in. And I saw for myself how satisfying it could be returning from Moss Street Market on a Saturday and counting the cash, especially in the middle of tomato season.
Yes, honestly, a very lucrative season.
Each farm was 1 acre, yes. And on 1 acre easily made $4,000. This was 16 years ago, 12 years ago.
When money was worth slightly more, yes, indeed. Yes, it's...
On one day.
Do you, just looking back over the training experience you got about the business side of farming, do you see that farmers sometimes have a problem with having the business model they need to have in order to make a go of it? That's sometimes something they need to learn specifically so they understand.
Absolutely. I would start off with educating. Education is so important. Instead of just going onto to the land thinking that you could do this, by educating yourself initially, you save yourself a lot of money and heartache.
For sure.
And that's why I keep pushing for alternative schools as well from a young age. One of them being the Waldorf model that incorporates.
So you learn a broader way of looking at things, a more holistic way, and include the nitty-gritty of making sure that you have enough money at the end of the day to survive.
Exactly, and for students to start thinking from a very young age about what they would like to do with their lives and how that could benefit them or not.
Now, somewhere in the middle of this, you had a bit of a chance meeting with someone who later, as time unfolded, led you to an important new relationship, and that is Haida Hameri, the woman who, with her husband, founded Gaia College. First of all, I think it was a bit of a serendipitous encounter. What happened?
Haida visited the farm, and it was at the time where one of the visions of this incubator farm was education. And in our reports, we noticed that we couldn't really report back on the education, even though we did it by chance, because we were so busy growing food. And Haida offered a wonderful opportunity to fulfill that vision with a growing food course being taught at the farm in an educational space.
So how did that come about? Was that a discussion, we need a course, and then she said, I'd like to do a course, and how did that go? I mean, it's always a very personal process. It's a very individual process.
I didn't know that the college existed, and then she also started many other, the Society of Urban Land Care, educating landscapers as well. And then once I realized that I wanted to take the growing food course, which I did, and then after that she asked me to take the organic master gardener course. So I, with the actual practicality of being on farm, the on-farm teaching, learning by doing, worked so well.
And that's how the course was constructed, a mixture of sort of academic instruction, but also a lot of hands-on stuff.
Exactly. The first part would be, very shortly, this is what we're going to be doing today. let's go and do it.
So you spent a lot of time in the field.
I did.
As part of, did Gaia and the Halliburton Farm community kind of work together, or was it, were they kind of doing their separate thing?
They had a contract with us, with the society, and Royal Roads University. And it was a community. I learned the value once more of collaboration.
Sure.
Collaboration and sustainable collaboration. To this day, we are all part of an organic community forum. People are posting, I have a job for a landscaper this summer. How do I get rid of spider mites in my greenhouse? To this day, there are reunions. There are class reunions. We visited each other's gardens, and it stays. That stays with you.
So what was it about Gaia College and the atmosphere there and the course that you took and the way it was structured that has stayed not only with you but also with other students who were also part of that program? What is it that captured your imagination, your hearts?
As with here at the Teaching Garden, it's the people. First of all, they're there because they care. They're studying this because they care. And it's the notion of producing something you could eat at the end of the day that's so delicious, knowing that it's good for you, knowing why it's good for you, why it tastes so good.
And why it's something that everybody could start doing a little bit of here and there. It's not a secluded area that only certain people can go to or participate in.
Exactly.
There's a kind of democratization about Mother Nature's energies. They are available to everybody who attunes themselves to them.
Exactly. You can do it on your patio in a pot, clay pot. You can do it in a friend's garden, in your own back garden. And I learned the value of making bursaries available for education because the course cost, I think it was $800 at the time for per course. There was a wonderful organization, the Women's Institute. They sponsored students, anybody who wanted to take the course who couldn't afford it.
Really? So there was the collaboration between the college and the farm was even greater. There was a greater outreach going on into the larger community.
Exactly. The best part, Warren, was the local school visiting, and not just the one school, but then many more. And seeing the students, seeing how engaged they became, and seeing how happy they looked, and they started the Institute for Global Solutions in that time. Once more, wonderful teachers behind it all. And there I realized that our schools are now wonderfully seeing an increase in school food programs, that the society's Shoe Swap Food Action Society is
very actively involved.
Very actively involved in. Yeah. Very important. And also the students themselves, giving them opportunity for alternative learning.
You had told me when we were talking before about how big an impact your time associated with Gaia College had been. And so I went to their website to look up some of the principles that underlie what was trying to be accomplished there. And the first thing is not to do with food or medicine. Their core purpose is described as cultivating community. And you just described how that was put into operation. But clearly that's a higher goal than just producing healthy food for as many people as possible. That's creating a new model of human interaction and behavior.
A wonderful, loving, sustainable model.
It goes on from there. The vision is to be a global community, not just local, of educators, professionals, and students working and learning in the areas of holistic land management, health, and environmentally sustainable technologies. So the vision is more concrete, but it's also very broad. It starts out with this notion of a global community. We're not just here on Vancouver Island. We're part of a very big process.
That's true. And being online, they are able to do that.
Yes.
With their courses, the students have access to those courses, all the alumni, for years afterwards.
You needed, as you were saying earlier, you needed the experience of actually going out on the land and getting dirt under your fingernails as well. And the mission for Gaia College, the first thing that's there is the notion of teaching a conscious way of living and working with nature. In other words, it's deliberate, it's out in the open, we are aware of what we're doing. That must have really encouraged a lot of dialogue within among the students and between the students and the faculty. Were a lot of conversations going on there?
They were, and it was so interesting to see how each individual gravitated towards their own passion. Some had a passion to grow the indigenous plants, others had a passion for seed, to start seed saving and to clean the seed. And by the way, there's a seed cleaning machine that a group of people in Vancouver have, the Farm Folk City Folk.
Yes, indeed.
Organization.
Know them
and
well.
They're looking for a base for their seed cleaning machine here in the Shoe Swap.
Are they?
So
well, let's invite them in. Let's find a place.
That would be a great educational opportunity right there.
I wonder if it's the sort of thing that might even fit in with the Zest, you know, so that anybody could use it. They have the machine and,
exactly.
Come there one evening with a bunch of tomato seeds and head out with all fresh, spruced up, looking like they're ready to be planted.
Exactly. And the best part of all was, it was always accompanied with food. Now, you want the best food in town? Come to a potluck of growers of food. All the courses at Gaia College ended like that. And we brought food from our own gardens during the season. It was so meaningful. And it's happening here, too. It happens once a month at the teaching garden. And it's accompanied by learning. The last one we had, Sarah, our wonderful new volunteer, stepped up to plant a bee garden there and teach her passion for bees while she's obtaining her doctorate, I believe, PhD. Hmm. She is now involved, and it was very well attended, so we decided to have one potluck a month at the teaching garden accompanied by food. The food is out of this world. It's Melanie and Serena and the board of this Food Action Society are exceptional, and they put out request that the food, try and make it local. Bring it from your own backyard if you can, and that's what makes it so meaningful.
I'm just floating along on the words you're sharing with us, because they I mean, it's showing a vision that I think is the vision that really we aspire to if we think about it. We don't even know about it if we've shut that part of our minds off. But as soon as the ideas come into a person's mind, they spark a lot of response. And the next Gaia College principle is facilitating holistic thinking, not thinking in a narrow way, but thinking in a broad way. That seems to me something that we all have to start doing.
Taking advocacy for our own health, yes. Advocating for our own health, for sure.
Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Elmarie Roberts, who's a lifelong teacher and working as a volunteer teacher at the Shoe Swap Food Action Society's Teaching Garden, which is, as you've described, Elmarie, a wonderful place to go for a meal on certain days, but also a place to go to actually do something. You know, you said a couple of times, walking the talk, and the garden is a place where you can definitely walk, you can kneel, you can crawl around on your hands and knees, but you're there in the field. One final thing from the principles behind Gaia College, which I think is quite relevant, and that is the notion of demonstrating stewardship and regeneration. In other words, not just talking about it or writing in a manual, but actually actualizing it, putting into play?
Regenerative agriculture and once more looking after something as if it's belongs to everybody, not just ourselves. That's the essence of stewardship. And teaching that is a major leap forward to being effective, not just locally, but also globally.
Now, you came to Salmon Arm for the reason that you might have come to this country in part, and that was that one of your daughter came here with the two grandchildren. The magnet, the family magnet, was established, and you responded and moved here. What was it like moving? The Vancouver Island ecosystem is quite bucolic. It's gentle. It's moderated by the influence of the ocean all around it. You come to Salmon Arm, the seasons are a little more pronounced, a little more obvious. And this is even further away from the warm climate of South Africa. So what was it like coming to this part of the world for you?
We love Salmon Arm. My daughter, my wonderful son-in-law, our grandchildren, since we've landed here, we love the difference, the absolute distinction between the seasons, the intensity of it, fast and furious. You have to do everything in a hurry to be effective. And
you plant things that grow quickly.
It doesn't necessarily mean rushing, yes.
Yes, indeed. No, absolutely. So here you are in Salmon Arm with the short seasons that you have to pay attention to. But I think you started to plant a few flowers anyway. What kind of flowers did you plant?
At the teaching garden, it varies every year to make it interesting. Mm-hmm. So far, I've just been here a year. Last year, I planted amaranth, red amaranth. Mm-hmm. And I like planting edible flowers.
Yes, seed.
So seed. The seed of amaranth is quinoa. Yeah. And another wonderful edible flower is calendula, and an all-round companion, and borage, with beautiful little blue star.
Tastes source like of it, evening primrose, or of the fatty acid that's found in evening primrose.
Yeah, it tastes like cucumber, actually.
Yeah.
Borage.
The you also had some flowers in your own place, didn't you? One or two little pots here and there.
Yes. Once more, that varies.
I want listeners to know that you don't go far from some member of the family of flowers that delight us all over the world.
My wonderful neighbor loves geranium, so I put that in a pot for her. But I also interspersed it with sunflowers, amaranth.
Can you grow anything here that is found in your natal land?
The baobab has to pass through the intestines of an elephant before it can germinate, so we'll count.
So bring an elephant, then.
We'll count that out. Nasturtiums.
Yeah.
Good old nasturtiums. And yes. Yes.
So you found out about the Shoestrop Food Action Society. How did you find out about them? Here you are, new in town. You're looking around to see what's up.
Wonderful things happen when one volunteers.
Yes, indeed.
As you know, I decided to pick a few volunteer spaces, and then was sold when I volunteered there, because there was one wonderful woman, Rita. She loves weeding, and I was mesmerized by the fact that she transcends into another realm when she weeds and how fast she does it. Uh-huh. And the wonderful mentorship of Sue Moore, just being there with her extensive knowledge, and then connecting to her farm on Notch Hill, where the St. Marie family now mm-hmm. are. You've interviewed them.
Yes,
2 weeks ago. And to see how that is progressing in the form of something sustainable, which is permaculture. And a permaculture guild being formed at the Enderby seat swap earlier this year.
Yes.
We're learning that there are very good times for education, and it's the shoulder seasons. It's January and February, and then from September onwards. In the summer, people are very busy in their
of
own
course.
Gardens.
Yeah, spring and summer.
So Seedy Saturdays work very well in January.
Yes.
The next weekend after New Year is the best time for a Seedy Saturday. The one in Enderby was There were so many people.
Yeah.
And the Permaculture Guild formed. So it's a group of people wanting to be part of something sustainable, and they're visiting each other's farms. The next one is going to be in Glen Eden. And forgive me, I can't remember the family there and the farm name. But look on the Food Action Society website. Anybody can go. And once you've visited one of these farms, you can see the possibility. And you can see the sharing, and you can see the value in, I can give this, and I need this.
Why don't you give listeners a sort of compact definition of what the principles in permaculture are? It's a very distinctive world, but as a master gardener from Gaia College, you're somebody who can really share that with everybody.
I discovered permaculture, the actual principles, a little late in my life, even though I have exercised it. But the 16 principles range from observation to the end one, embrace change. And it's not just a principle you can use in your garden. It's now spilling over into social systems as well. It's spilling into education. I mentioned the world of school. It's spilling into economics, TEQs in the economic world. It's something that's fun. If it's not fun, we don't tend to extend it. It's got to be fun, and it's sustainable. So it's observation, and I can give you the 16 principles now. But
what would you say is the essential principle, the thing that underlies everything in permaculture?
Yes, David Holmgren and Mollison from Australia, who founded this wonderful movement many moons ago,
indeed,
so wise, they realized that our world, as we all know today, it's causing anxiety, and it's not good. So they're looking at a different world, if you like, and came up with something that really works. It works. Once more, it's education. There are many, many sources out there on the websites and YouTubes of the world. But the one that I always go back to is permacultureprinciples.com. And there are songs you can learn at school. Children learn it, and that helps them remember it.
Sure.
And it to me, energy storage, yielding, self-regulation. How often do we self-regulate? We have to look what worked. For example, last year at the teaching garden, I planted way too many tomatoes, and it became overwhelming. And it wasn't fun to put on a juice, because I wanted to send it all to Africa, and I couldn't. And we saved it as much as we could. So self-regulate. This year I have one row. That's enough for that area. Small and slow solutions. Just because something is small and slow, it doesn't mean it's not going to produce. We want things instantly today. We want it tomorrow. But we all know seeds grow slowly. And some value, diversity, the value of diversity work.
Yeah. That seems to me an essential part of permaculture. You don't just think of a plant in isolation. You think of it as part of a system of plants, an ecosystem, as we now use the term, and a term that we only started using a decade or two ago, a few decades ago. This idea of a complete system, always considered as the basis of what you're doing, never just one plant in isolation. It's the opposite of the sort of Cartesian model where you take everything apart and look at it separately. The essence of permaculture seems to be to look at things all together and how they interact and collaborate. Kind of like how Gaia College tries to run its operations, everybody talking to each other and working together.
You've summarized it so well.
How did you get into the garden? You didn't just walk up and say, here I am, I'm going to do this. How did that relationship develop with the Food Action Society that led to this very valuable role that you're playing with the garden?
Melanie, who is a young person out there of note, I should say.
Yes.
Wonderfully gifted and skilled, took me for a tour of the garden, and at the back there was this area that was covered over the winter, and it's not developed yet. And she stopped there and said, well, we're just working this far, so far. And after the tour, I was very careful in approaching her and asked her if she would like to give me the chance to develop it. And it won't cost any money. I won't cause any trouble. I'm going to try and get a grant to pay for my water.
Yes.
And that worked out so well. It was very satisfying.
She said, well, as long as you're going to pay for the water with a grant, that'll be okay. I'm sure Melanie jumped at the chance for you to do something with that part of the garden.
The whole society is so supportive. I met the board, and I'm so grateful for people making a difference in this town.
So what are you doing in that new part of the garden that is now being developed? What's happening there?
At the moment, we've had 1 year, and I love using it as a tool to illustrate the 16 permaculture principles in action.
So it's a teaching place as well as a growing place.
Yes, you can go there and say, this is how I've adapted to change. This is how I've used diversity. And the pictures to go with it, and the best would be a tour, yes. So at the beginning, I all thought, what is she doing up there? And I just prayed for patience and was really happy to see how it's developed over a year.
You mentioned change, and we're living in an era of change. Change both socially, in the relationships within the human community, but also changes in our relationship with the non-human community. And you made this point a couple of times, which I think is very central to these kinds of changes, and that is that all life forms are connected. With the changes that are taking place, that we have wrought to some degree on the planet, we have done things to make the planet warmer, we have done things to make the planet a little more, to contain chemicals that were never there before for millions and millions of years. How do you see this process unfolding and the answers to making it better and back to where it needs to be? What's your vision of where we're going in the future?
We're going to run into a wall, first of all, which we are already doing. And we're going to, as people did in England after the war with the Victory Gardens, we're going to create our own areas for food when we get cut off, happening right now on Vancouver Island. We have to gravitate towards places that either grow food or have food available locally when the supply chains get cut off. We can see the difference one person makes in this world for the better or for worse. We have to focus in on the good and learning from the good and learning from people who inspire us and not be afraid of our own greatness. This is what Mandela said. He said our greatest fear is that we could possibly do something wonderful one day. And bless his soul, he showed us that.
Coming across the oceans to another part of the world, bringing insights from the country you're born and raised in. Clearly you've learned and come to embody some of that kind of collaboration, just within your own consciousness, but also with other people. I do sense that some of the trends you just outlined, the trend for us to go to places where food can be produced and produce it for ourselves and slow down and shorten all those long delivery lines from other parts of the world is something that's starting to happen. And this show, Food Conversations, is all about that process. And even people who are major capitalists, people like Jimmy Pattison, are recognizing that by acquiring operations that are very local and saying, stay the way you are, don't change. I mean, he's making some money out of it, but he's also recognizing, as are many people, that we need to make the world we live in more favorable to all the creatures that live in it. Because if it is for them, it will be for us as well.
Oh, wonderful.
It's really been a delight to have you on the show, Elmeri. And I know already that you're having an impact at the Teaching Garden because I hear it from other people. And I think you're espousing a vision of the future that is the vision we can all embrace and feel good about. Thank you very much for being here.
Such a pleasure, Warren.